Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How did it get out of the docket?
The House Committee on Revenue for Thursday, March 24th, 2011, will come to order. We have a bunch of public hearings this morning, and I see a lot of interest. We're going to open first the public hearing on House Bill 2354. And why don't you give us a short explanation, and then we'll call the witnesses.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. House Bill 2354 would extend the sunset on the property tax exemption for nonprofits that own or lease housing for low-income residents. The measure would extend the sunset from July 1st, 2014 to July 1st, 2027 for these property tax exemptions. The exemption is limited to the tax levies of governing bodies that have adopted the provisions, and an exception would be in cases where properties have over 51% of their property tax levies that have adopted these provisions, and then all of the property tax in that case would be exempt. The exemption may also apply to properties being held by nonprofit organizations for the purpose of developing future low-income housing developments.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Representative Greenlick, you're here for the other bills. Yeah, thank you. We'll hear from Ms. Briggs, Mr. Anderson first. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for hearing us today on this important bill. I'm Kathy Briggs. I'm the director of the Oregon Opportunity Network, a statewide coalition that represents 37 of the most active nonprofit housing developers in the state. And our members have developed over 16,000 units of affordable housing, housing that provides stability to hardworking families and stability to communities.
And I'll note that we do have your testimony before us, so if you could summarize
and
give us the high points, that would be very useful.
The high points are that this exemption is very important because it gives local governments options to assess the needs in their community, the resources available, and make decisions about adopting tools that help them further their goals. And I think we have four jurisdictions that have adopted it. All four jurisdictions support this extension. And the direct beneficiaries of this exemption are really the hardworking residents and low-income people who live in the housing. There is a reduction of their rent. The additional resources they then have available to do things like buy food, school supplies, pay for gas, et cetera. So other jurisdictions who have not adopted it would like the option to do so in the future, which is one of the reasons we're asking for the extension to 2027 to provide some certainty and opportunity to evaluate, assess, et cetera. So the big high point of this is it meets an important need, and it's a local option that local governments have used and want to continue to use.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor.
Actually, Mr. Mayor's still in the audience.
Mr. Mayor's still in the audience.
Trott.
We came up in a different order than I said, didn't we? Okay, great. Thank you.
My name is Jonathan Trott. I am the housing director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We are a 501c3 not-for-profit affordable housing developer and sponsor. I'll also keep it brief. We've been around for about 25 years. We're based in Milwaukee. We have a presence statewide. We have about 1,500 units of affordable and supportive housing for Oregonians with low incomes and special needs. We've used this property tax exemption in the city of Portland and also in Wilsonville. And as Kathy said, it makes a significant difference in the lives of our residents because what it enables us to do is pass on the savings to them in the form of lower rents. In the materials Kathy submitted, you'll see two of our projects in Wilsonville. One is Autumn Park, and to put a little bit of a human face on this, Autumn Park has 144 units of family housing. There are 219 adults and 178 kids who live there. They are right across the street from an excellent middle school and elementary school. The average income there is about $2,000 a month. And the average savings to the residents is about $70 per month, or a little over $800 a year, that comes directly through this property tax exemption. Also in Wilsonville is Creekside Woods, which is leasing up right now. It is right next to the community center. It's a senior project. We expect when it fully leases up that the average income there will be about $13,000 a year. For the most part, it's people who are living on just Social Security, and their savings are $40 a month as a result of the property tax exemption. So this money is being used by these households on other necessities such as food, such as school supplies, such as clothing, such as medicine, and it's being spent locally here in the Oregon economy. So in sum, we've used this a lot. It's been great for our residents. It's made a difference, and we strongly support House Bill 2354 and urge the committee to vote it out of committee and onto the full House with its strong endorsement. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Brewer.
Oh, sorry. Yes. I thought you said Berger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one technical question, might be for staff. Does this property tax exemption only apply to those owned by nonprofits, or does it also apply to for-profit low-income housing partnerships as well?
This exemption is limited to nonprofits. Okay. There are some other exemptions that are also available for local adoption that are for all affordable housing, but this one is limited to nonprofits.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, why did we pick 2027?
It is tied to a 15-year tax credit program. The biggest housing program in the country is the low-income housing tax credit, which is an investment over 15 years. This is scheduled to a sunset into 2014. We are hoping for extension now, effective 2012, with a 15-year extension. That would make all of those projects that are in pre-development right now available and of interest to tax credit investors over a 15-year term. So there is some certainty around this with that kind of an extension that is compatible with a major federal program that provides private sector investment in housing.
So it's a federal tax credit.
It's a federal low-income housing tax credit.
And the sunset is on what? Is it on setting up the program? Is it on the property tax itself?
The sunset is on the property tax itself.
Okay.
So that in 2014, without an extension, local governments would no longer be able to exempt these taxes.
And all these existing units would go back on the property tax rolls?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two questions. The first, do we have a measure of how much the credit is costing the communities that choose to use it?
Well, we have an average of about $50 per month per unit. And so I did a little rough calculations. It's about $600,000. A year, and this is basically what the benefit of this kind of program is, that the local government gets to assess for itself the cost in terms of foregone revenue and balance it with the benefits. So the calculation around this is done at the local government level. Does that answer the question?
Yes, except I'm not sure where that $600,000 fits. Is that statewide? Is that one city?
That is one unit?
What is that?
Approximately $600,000 for the four jurisdictions that have adopted it. It's only the four this has only been adopted by four local jurisdictions.
And follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
This is slightly off point, and it certainly doesn't all arise from this one credit, but I'm just curious. One of the goals, of course, is that this would help folks. I was looking for the language here to move on. I'm just curious how long folks stay in these houses. Are there records that suggest that indeed this is a device that helps people move on up, or are we reaching a point where, when you talk about Social Security folks, is this a situation where folks pretty much find these places and stay there for the rest of their lives?
I think that's a very good question. I think it depends on the population you serve. Jonathan brought up we have profiles of six different projects, and I think if you have housing that's supportive housing that serves people with disabilities or people on a fixed income, Social Security retirement, for example, those folks, this might be where they live for the rest of their life. Others, when you serve families, folks who are working, perhaps at service sector jobs, part-time jobs, Many of our providers also provide associated resident services to help them with employment, GED, job preparation, et cetera. So in those situations, there's a positive turnover where they move on up the continuum into private market housing and home ownership. So a lot depends on the population you're serving. Is that helpful?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
It is helpful. I was just looking at the letter from the City of Portland where it says the public investment is supported because the ability to rent affordable unit assists families to move towards self-sufficiency. And I'm just wondering if that isn't missing what's really going on. I also wonder how we would find out if this is permanent housing or indeed temporary.
Again, I think it depends on the population. I think we have. I could certainly try and get you more information about that. We do have positive
turnovers. That's the right
answer. And we can get you more information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, perhaps this is more a question to you. Are we going to hear from some of the local jurisdictions who obviously are
is
required?
The mayor of Lincoln City is here. We also, of course, have a written testimony from Commissioner Nick Fish from Portland.
Okay. I guess then I do have a question to just wonder about how the various special districts and other kinds of taxing authorities, understanding that that is a majority of the tax rate, approval from the majority of the tax rate is required, how would you characterize the reactions from those folks?
I think there are also letters of support, I believe, City of Wilsonville, City of Tigard, Washington County sent a letter of endorsement for this, even though they currently don't use this option. They want to have that.
And the City of Eugene.
And the City of Eugene.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Mayor Anderson can speak to the specifics of how those local decisions are made, but there's generally a hearing and sometimes presentations to the local school districts, et cetera. So I know there is local governments, the taxing districts, opt-in, opt-out together on this.
Right, and maybe it's appropriate, Mr. Chair, to follow up with a little more detail when the mayor's up.
Right, and I think that also may be a question for staff. One of the attributes of this particular bill is that the key sections of the law are not actually in the bill, so we ought to look at those a little further. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
We appreciate. Will get you more information about the succession and of the resident. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Anderson, Janet Byrd. Good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs, committee members. My name is Dick Anderson. I am the mayor of Lincoln City. I'm here to speak today in support of House Bill 2354. Lincoln City is a community on the Central Oregon coast whose major industry is tourism. Our population is approximately 8,000 with a service area population of 15,000 and a summer season population that grows to over 30,000. Because we are a tourism community, we employ heavily in the support service industry, which generally pays minimum wage, thus contributing greatly to Lincoln County's median income being one of the lowest in the state. At the same time, our housing costs are high due to the demand of our natural beauty. Second homes and homes used as nightly rentals have contributed to the dramatic increase in housing prices due to demand for our scenic coastal location. In Lincoln City, we have a housing gap, or better noted as the inability of our workforce to afford housing in our community, thus contributing to numerous social issues along with the workforce concerns. Workforce affordable housing remains a primary need in our community, even in today's economic climate. Lincoln City has previously chosen to take advantage of the tools provided in this ORS, which allows local government to exempt affordable housing properties from paying property taxes, thereby lowering rents to make housing accessible to more community members. We appreciate this local government option, which allows us the local government as a local level, at a local level, to assess our needs and to match it with solutions. As in this case, to actually give up cherished income to our city to facilitate the delivery of a much-needed product, affordable workforce housing for our citizens. Lincoln City is one of the few communities outside the Portland metropolitan area that has embraced and utilized this tool. We have chosen to exercise this option as a local government to facilitate the existence of six properties representing 283 rental units. These properties provide affordable housing in our community to a segment of our workforce that would not generally realize such. And still, we have a need. In fact, we are also supporting and facilitating the efforts of local land trust options that would allow citizens the opportunity to purchase a home, thus stabilizing their housing situation even further and rooting them more firmly in our community. Hopefully you are agreeing with my comments this morning and recognize the need, but are asking yourself the question, why deal with this issue now? This committee certainly has bigger issues at hand. That is correct. However, the extension of this sunset to 2027 allows communities like Lincoln City to plan ahead as well as to provide some predictability for those partners that we find that are willing to assist us in developing our affordable housing need. I strongly request your support and passage of House Bill 2354 so that local governments can better utilize the few tools we have to meet the needs of our citizens and our community. Thank you for your time and serving the Oregon citizens.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and we convene the Housing Alliance, which is a statewide coalition of about 60 organizations concerned with the lack of affordability in our communities. I know that you have many issues ahead of you today, and so I won't take up very much time. You have my written testimony. I wanted to talk a little bit about what drives the Housing Alliance, and that's the need that we see throughout Oregon in all of our communities. We've provided with my testimony just a sampling of some fact sheets that we prepare by county, and we didn't give you every county. I apologize. We do have every county available on our website, and we'd be happy to provide those. But we see across Oregon a real, at every income level, a struggle for folks to find affordable housing. It's particularly pressing for folks on fixed incomes. It's true in the cities. It's true in rural areas. And so we see this tool represented in House Bill 2354 as a really important tool for local governments to help us meet this really pressing and compelling need. I think all the other points that I would make have been addressed by other witnesses. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about the bill.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, we've been talking a lot about situations where tax credits aren't necessary for the purpose, but just happen to be available, so they get used. In this situation, are these rents paid by folks who are in this type of housing, paid by the folks in the housing, or are they on one of the HUD arrangements? Where's the money come from that is paying the rent, and indeed, is this $50 money they save, or is it being saved by some other organization that's actually paying the rent?
Do you want me to take that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, so a couple things. One is that, and you'll see in the letters that came from the jurisdictions, they've all made assessments of policy goals and how this exemption program would help them meet their policy goals. The housing is housing owned by nonprofit owners, and so there's typically a very complex set of subsidies that goes in. If you're trying to reach very, very low income people, people on fixed incomes, people coming out of homelessness, requires a really complex mix of subsidies. So some of those people might also be meeting federal be receiving federal assistance, or there might be federal assistance going into those properties through community development block grants or other. It's typically a fairly complicated financing package. When folks are charged rent, if they're receiving federal subsidy, it's all based as a percentage of their income. So there's a lot of work and monitoring that goes on to ensure compliance with program regulations. The city of Portland also, they reference in their testimony, they just had their property tax exemption programs audited, and they found really compelling evidence of good monitoring in this program as well as compelling public benefit. So I think I'd be happy to sit down with you or send folks to visit with you and go through some of these details, but there's not double dipping. There may be layering of subsidy to reach very low income populations or populations with special needs, developmental disabilities, mental illness, et cetera. But there's not double dipping.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Right. I actually wasn't so much suggesting double dipping as I was trying to focus on who actually is getting the $50. And the letters here would suggest that this $50 is going to stay in these folks' pocket for other purposes. But if they're, in fact, not paying the $50 to begin with, that argument
Thank
would
you.
Appear to be a little lame. And so that's where I'm trying to go with the question.
Well, and if I may, it seemed to me that part of your question was, would somebody else pay the $50 if the property taxpayers didn't?
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Let me try to take a shot at that based on what we see in our portfolio. The vast majority of our residents are paying their rent in full out of their own dollars. So when in both of these properties, when I'm talking about $70 saved, $40 saved, that's the Oregon taxpayer. We do have some properties where the building has federal subsidies, like you've talked about, Section 8, and the residents, their rent is scaled to their income. Now, on those properties, you get into a slightly different dynamic. I think one thing I really need to stress about the affordable housing that my organization builds and other organizations build is that it's really private sector driven. Most of the money comes from federal low-income housing tax credits and a first mortgage. In cases where the property taxes are reduced and the federal government is paying the majority of the rent, what that does is it enables us to leverage more private sector dollars. So our first mortgage can get bigger, and what that means is the amount of other dollars, really scarce local dollars that always round out a budget, can get smaller. I don't know if I answered it or if I muddied it, but I what I want to stress is that one way or another, this is helping residents and also helping get this kind of housing built.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Having represented numerous folks in the private sector utilizing the very opportunities you've just described, I'm familiar with the program.
Oh, great.
What I'm interested in doing today is just putting a finer point on the nature of the $50, and I think we're doing that. And so for purposes of what I'm trying to achieve, I think I'm done with this issue, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. And I admit this may be for the mayor in a sort of a follow-up. You're not going to approve a project if somebody else, other than the tenant, would pay the amount of the property tax. You're not going to approve a project for a property tax abatement in that situation, would you?
Well,
if there was someone outside who was going to pay that money instead,
or Mr. Chairman, if we could find someone to pay, we would. You realize we're giving up our own
right.
income. From
I mean, you're giving up money that you otherwise spend on the police and
correct
streets and schools and all of those other things.
Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. It doesn't come easy for a city, for a local government to give up their income. So we spend a lot of time analyzing and balancing our need between our citizens needing housing and what them not having adequate housing creates in our community.
And I assume you take into account the issues that Representative Bentz has raised.
Correct.
When you consider this kind of an application.
Exactly.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to ask a version of the same question I asked before, could you describe how you might characterize the reactions of the other taxing authorities who are not represented amongst the letters that we have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, actually, we've just recently approved a project, so we've had the experience of dealing with what happens is public testimony is created where the project owner, in this case the CDC of Lincoln City, makes a pitch to local governments and other jurisdictions in order to get to the 51%. And typically they touch all taxing jurisdictions. We, in our case, what we did was check with the other ones to see, check their temperature, see where they were, even though we got to the 51% before they were being asked. So far, as I've indicated, we have six properties. Nobody likes giving up income, right. Clearly. But they also are going through the same exercise that we do at local city government, is there's a need for housing and a screaming need in our community because of the high cost. So as much as you dislike giving up income, you recognize that if you don't, you won't have housing, and so you do. And like say, 283 units in our case is what we've done so far.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I continue to wonder, since we haven't heard, and it doesn't appear we will hear directly from some of the other authorities, the special districts and the schools and so on, that their silence is what that indicates.
I always assume,
yeah.
Representative Reed, that if someone doesn't show up, it's because it's fine with them.
Thank you.
If it's someone who's affected by it. And you're right, of course, special districts and other taxing authorities are affected by the decisions that you make in connection with this kind of issue. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, just as a point of order, at least specifically to our area, we're inundated heavily with second home real estate that pays property taxes without really, you know, putting services or tapping services such as schools. So in our case, the school system gets a lot of property taxes from second homes where there's no kids, tapping. So it's a balance that we deal with. Hopefully that helps.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on House Bill 2354? And if not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2354. And I'm going to open the public hearings that involve issues involving tobacco altogether. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2110, House Bill 2231, House Bill 2533, and House Bill 2385. Dave, you want to give us a brief explanation of these, and then we'll hear from Representative Greenleck.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, four bills in front of you. I made a four-page summary of what the bill does, and then some background information. The very first page of the handout, this packet, four-page packet, starting with cigarette tax, other tobacco tax, and distribution.
Which packet is that one in?
It's the headline is cigarette tax, other tobacco tax, and distribution.
Okay. Commissioner Kafoury, are you here? Oh, there you are. You want to come up? Mm-hmm. Oh, Senator Monis Anderson. Thank you. There's so many people in the room, I'm not aware of who's here. Senator, do you want to be heard?
She's coming down.
She's not here yet.
She's not here. She's coming down. And you're in the middle.
Yes.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So in the packet, I compared three bills that change cigarette tax and or other tobacco taxes against the current law. The current law, the cigarette tax is $1.18 per pack of 20. House Bill 2110 increases it to $2.15. House Bill 2533 increases the cigarette tax to $3.60 plus per pack of 20, and House Bill 2231 increases cigarette tax to $2.18. And these two bills, actually, House Bill 2110 and 2533, change distribution of cigarette tax collections. And then about other tobacco tax products, distribution stays the same, except House Bill 2110 changes other tobacco taxes. And the summary you will find in the packet. And the other three are background information.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, thank you for your patience while we listen to about housing and the property tax.
That is most interesting. Thank you very much, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you very much for having me here. I'll testify specifically on 2231, but I frankly have no pride of ownership. I'll take whichever one comes along. Just to give you a moment of my background to tell you where I'm coming from on this tax, I spent 30 years as a director of research for Kaiser Permanente doing a lot of substance abuse and disease prevention research, particularly around tobacco and other addictive products. And then I spent 10 years as chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at the medical school. So this has been a big piece of my life throughout my experience. The unusual thing about a cigarette tax is that its main purpose isn't to collect revenue. Its main purpose is to reduce revenue. In fact, the purpose of a cigarette tax, in my mind, and the number one purpose, is to reduce the use of the product. Tobacco is the most addictive product probably that we'll deal with at any time. It's more addictive than heroin. And the important thing about tobacco is that if people don't start using the product in their teen years, they are very unlikely to become addicted to this product. So in my mind, the higher the tax, the better, because you'll hear from some of your staff that the demand is very sensitive to the price, particularly among adolescents. The higher the tax on cigarettes, the smaller the probability that an adolescent will begin smoking. If an adolescent doesn't begin smoking, the lifetime effect of that is quite extraordinary, because their probability of dying from a tobacco-related disease, or perhaps equally important, living with a tobacco-related disease — anybody watch anybody live with emphysema, you know how serious that is enhanced the extent to which we raise the price of cigarettes that adolescents face. A dollar a pack tax would still have us at a lower tax rate than the state of Washington. It's something we worry about, and it seems to me it's an extraordinarily important thing to do. It also raises some revenue, but big chunks of the revenue that it raises goes to get people not to smoke. So this is very different. I've been accused of never seeing a tax I didn't like, and that's not entirely true. But this is a tax I love, because it meets such an important social function, and that social function is to reduce this epidemic of smoking in our population. I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Happy to have my colleagues here.
Welcome, Senator.
My commissioner is here.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I will not go into why I feel cigarettes and smoking is bad for you, because I think my representative to the right of me did that very well. But I am here to talk about and testify in support of House Bill 2385. And it is a bill to lift the preemption on local tobacco taxes. I introduced a bill similar to this last session, and I would love it if you would move this forward this session. My county and counties across Oregon are struggling to find fund basic services. And as a state lawmaker, I know how much responsibility we put on our counties, a lot, to provide services as varied as maintaining roads and bridges, to libraries, to running local jails. And I also know that counties have very few tools at their disposal to address their budget shortfalls. And I feel this is one way that maybe we can accomplish that. I am worried that things for our local partners are going to get a whole lot worse before they get better. And as the state budget cuts start moving forward, I am really worried about what's happening to my county. And that's why I'm supporting this bill. I also support House Bill 2385 because, as a former public health nurse, I've seen the toll tobacco does take on lives, health, on their health, and on the state in terms of increased health care costs. Right now, even with the opening of these hookah bars, if you've read the latest public report, Public Health Department report, the increase of smoking is occurring among women in particular. So, thank you, committee, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Commissioner, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing us to have this hearing this morning. My name is Deborah Cafori. I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2385, but we are supportive of all the bills that are before you today. Senator Monica Sanderson talked a little bit about how we have had a similar bill like this before. In fact, in 2009, this bill passed the House, and unfortunately, in the waning days of the Senate, weren't able to get it through. But we're asking you to consider this bill again this session for three reasons. First, it's important. Senator Monica Sanderson talked about how hamstrung we are at local government in our tools we need to raise revenue when we are under such hard times. And I don't need to talk to you about the difficult times we're all facing. I think we're all in the same boat. We are your partners. The tasks that you have before you, are most of them are done at the county level. So when you look towards your health and your human services, we're the ones who perform these duties in the local communities. We meet with the constituents. We have the relationships with all of our constituents that are in dire need. Second, we know that it can work. According to the National Center for Tobacco-Free Kids, more than 450 local jurisdictions have a cigarette tax. Even the state of Virginia, which is a tobacco-growing state, allows counties and cities to add their own tax. Alabama has 240 cities and 46 counties with their own cigarette tax. As you may know, in Oregon and many states, cigarettes are taxed at the distributor level, and we in Oregon pay the distributors to administer this tax. We believe that adding a local tax stamp on cigarettes would not be overly burdensome, and any administrative costs, which are inherent in any revenue-raising effort, could be passed along to the county. This has worked in other states, such as Alabama, which requires distributors to purchase county revenue stamps from the Department of Revenue. Third, and this is something we hear a lot, price difference. Price differences are already occurring. And we don't believe that local tobacco taxes will put retailers at a competitive disadvantage. We often hear that by raising the tax in one county, it'll just drive consumers across the county lines. This week, my office conducted a price comparison on the same brand of cigarettes at various retail outlets within a five-mile radius in southeast Portland. And I've attached a map for your consideration. What you can see is that each store charges a different price for the exact same product. And what this demonstrates to me is you don't need to cross county lines. You can cross the street. Most people buy cigarettes out of convenience, and they are not going to go across county lines. You can see there's in just less than a two-mile radius, we have a price difference of almost a dollar a pack. I would also like to mention that we conducted the same price comparison a year ago on the exact same product. And I shared that information with the Senate Revenue Committee. And what's interesting to note is while Oregon has not passed a cigarette tax increase in 15 years, the price of these products in these stores are continuing to go up. And in just 1 year, one outlet raised the price by 61 cents. So I appreciate this time this morning, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have, and hopefully we'll continue to have this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of convenience, I was reading an interesting article the other day about the state of New Hampshire that was talking about the idea of dropping their cigarette tax rate in order to raise revenue so they would be more competitive. The reporter went out and spoke with individuals in convenience stores purchasing cigarettes who pointed out that the cigarettes were already cheaper in New Hampshire than where they purchased them, and saving another 10 to 15 cents per pack was not going to cause them to drive across the state line. They just wanted to get their pack of cigarettes. And
especially
I would imagine
gas prices going through the roof, it's going to be hard to think that someone's going to drive into a different county.
Exactly. And I would just thank all of you for supporting these. Anything that we could do to eliminate smoking altogether is a great thing. I appreciate Representative Greenlick's comments. While there is always potential revenue in a tobacco tax increase, the greatest success would be to have less revenue than we expected because fewer people were purchasing these products. Because, of course, we all know tobacco is the only product when used exactly as directed will kill you. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't be in the business of selling them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your all coming this morning, and we have an enormous list this morning.
Thank you for hearing.
Thank you very much.
Wayne Brady, Chris Girard, Richard Posen. Please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Bernhardt, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brady. I'm a volunteer for the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. And I'm here in opposition to all of these bills. I think we have much too high a taxes as it is, and this particular tax is very regressive. Low-income people tend to smoke more. It seems like the testimony we just heard, we have a conflict in objectives here, whether it's raising revenue or stopping people from smoking. But if you're looking for revenue, it seems to me that you're really killing the goose by raising the taxes too high. So I find the argument that it won't cause people to buy out of the county for these local taxes a little hard to believe, but I don't have any data to support my opinion. So I've given you a set of arguments in the handout, and I think that we need to be looking for ways of saving money rather than raising taxes, especially with the economy being what it is.
Thank you, sir. And now,
are there any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Brady? Thank you. Mr. Brady, we appreciate your testimony. Why don't we bring up Mark Nelson as well, with the other two that are coming now? Thank you. Gentlemen.
Good morning, co-chairs. My name is Chris Girard, and I'm president and CEO of Plaid Pantries, Inc. I won't read my testimony to you since I provided written copies, but I'd just like to summarize a couple. Plaid operates 104 stores, mostly in Oregon. We have 750 employees. Our company provides a full range of benefits for them, including health insurance. About 18% of Oregonians use tobacco, and tobacco is already very heavily taxed at both the state and the federal level. And so we're opposed to the increasing the taxes on these. We don't believe it's fair to single out a small minority of Oregonian citizens who happen to use tobacco. It's a very regressive tax. It's a selective tax. And if we're going to ask citizens to help with Oregon's budget difficulties, and I think we should ask everyone to help. It's also not a good idea to raise taxes following such a deep recession and the slow recovery that we're in, but I don't know if any of the members of the committee have friends or know people that use tobacco, but I'd like to tell you that we see them in our stores every day. About a third of our customers purchase tobacco products. These folks are going through what everybody else is in the recession with their personal finances. They're mostly working folks. Some of them have lost their jobs. And it's just not a good reason to me to single them out to bear the burden of this tax increase. Oregon, of course, relies on tobacco revenue. It's a declining source. Consumption is declining. These continual tax increases, however, are forcing more and more illegal black market, gray market, untaxed product into a number of different sources. The most recent one is the pretty big increase in roll-your-own tobacco, because bulk tobacco is taxed considerably less than manufactured product. Higher taxes only drive that trend and further in that direction, and the irony is that what you have left, who you have left paying the taxes, are tax-abiding citizens who don't go to the black market, and tax and law-abiding retailers who comply with the law. Another consideration is the cross-border shopping. Mr. Malik and I sometimes get into dueling elasticity arguments. He wouldn't give me his number this morning, and I see that he's not up there to help you. So you'll have to accept my number. And that is a range of 2.3 million to up to 3.9 million cartons will go away, taxable cartons. Round it to 3 million, that means that raising this tax, if the units stayed the same, and they won't, taking the 3 million away, you're going to lose potential 30 million in from the $1 tax. But remember, you also lose that $1.18 per pack that you're getting now on those 3 million. Raising taxes will increase revenue. I can't say that that won't happen, but typically you don't get what you expect, and usually it's less than that. I'd also like to point out that companies such as Plaid that sell tobacco aren't getting rich doing so. When we were kind of tax collectors, we collect a dollar and a penny for the federal government, $1.18 for Oregon, and I don't think I'm compromising trade secrets here. Our company makes gross profit about 58 cents on a pack of cigarettes. What we take to our shareholders in earnings is 4 cents. And actually, we don't pay dividends. We reinvest it in the company. But the other 54 cents is multiplied through the economy. Half of that goes to jobs, wages, and benefits for our employees. 40% of that goes to about 300 mostly Oregon small businesses who service our stores, provide supplies, air conditioning, and that type of thing. What's left after that goes to property taxes and income taxes. So the direct consumption tax, especially if there isn't a substitute product, a legal substitute product, it's just a real blunt instrument for raising revenue, in our opinion. And it's not just that single pack sale, because there's value added from transportation, wholesale distribution, the retail function, and then the people that spend those earnings, multiplying it throughout the economy. So such a huge tax increase, especially in today's very soft economy, really only hurts two areas, and that's the already cash-strapped consumer and Oregon's economy itself. Plaid shareholders are going to get their 4 cents. But when companies are faced with significant sales decreases, especially on low-margin items like tobacco, the only thing that businesses can do is reduce labor, other discretionary remodeling growth plans, and this just negatively impacts our supplier partners and the economy as a whole. Now's not the time to raise taxes on anything. It's especially a bad time to raise taxes so significantly on only a small group of Oregonians who are struggling like everybody else in a tough economy. Thank you for hearing me, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Cosasan on behalf of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which is a statewide association primarily consisting of small independent retail establishments throughout the state. I distributed a one-page sheet outlining the cigarette tax history for the last basic 20-year period. And I'd like to highlight, I think, a couple of issues with that. If one were to take a look at the receipts that the state has received during the last 3 to 4 year fiscal year period, you see a fairly consistent decline in revenue from 06-07 to the 09-10 fiscal year. You're down cumulatively about 16%. So I don't, in terms of a tax policy tying a desired revenue stream to a declining revenue base, to me is a little bit inconsistent. I think one of the most interesting pieces of this, if one were to take a look at it, is the tax itself. A tax unit, if we were to take a look at what a penny in tax would generate today as opposed to recent years, if one were to take a look at the 97-98 fiscal year receipts, a penny in our tax would generate $2.7 million in revenue per year. Today, 2009-2010, we're less than $1.7 million per year in a penny in tax. So again, you're definitely seeing a decline in that revenue base. I think what is somewhat interesting with that, I think that the chart will demonstrate that the state continues to lose a significant amount of otherwise legitimate tax revenues. If you look to your neighbor to the north, Washington, their Department of Revenue estimated last year that they were losing well over $200 million a year in otherwise legitimate tax revenues. In Oregon, I think if you look at the chart and pay attention to the Department of Revenue and the flow of numbers, they would suggest that you're losing probably close to a third of otherwise legitimate tax revenues. In terms of the differential between Oregon and Washington, the tax rate has been noted as significantly different. But if you look at your surrounding states in terms of California, Idaho, Nevada, Oregon is not low as opposed to those other states. In terms of a specific segregation between Washington State and Oregon, I think one should take a look at the per capita consumption numbers. Oregon, you are on a per capita basis about 45 packs per capita. And Washington, 25, maybe 26 packs. So if you were to lose your differential between Oregon and Washington, again, the impact, I think, is going to be more significant than people think. And I would like to address 2385, the bill to lift the preemption. I empathize with counties. They are strapped just like everyone else. But if one were to take a look at where the tax revenues flow today, keep in mind that about 72.5% of all tax revenues in terms of cigarette tax through the Oregon cigarette tax goes directly to the Oregon Health Plan. The impact if Multnomah County, for example, imposed a fairly significant tax, and the lost sales, probably to Washingtonians, I think you would have an immediate and fairly significant impact to the health plan, and I think you could estimate that readily. With that, Mr. Chair, I would thank you and the committee, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent R.J. Reynolds, and I should also mention I represent 7-Eleven, who concurs in both Mr. Garrod's and Mr. Kosasan's testimony. I want to dwell a little bit more on who pays the tax. Tobacco companies don't pay this tax. Oregonians pay this tax, and obviously smoking Oregonians pay this tax. I've handed out a Oregon smoker profile, and which I have provided to you before. These numbers are a little bit different than what you've seen before, but they reflect, I think, the same type of profile that we've discussed with you in the past. 43.67% of the smokers in Oregon earn under $25,000 a year. If you go to the next step, those earning under $35,000 a year were at 57.39%. Over half of the smokers in Oregon earn under $35,000 a year. And these are the people that pay this tax. You know, they pay, and I have another chart for you that you find on your third page. They both pay about $202 million in Oregon cigarette taxes. They pay another $82.3 million in master settlement charges for smoking. So approximately 476,000 people in Oregon who smoke, of which over half earn under $35,000, are paying $280 million to the state of Oregon for the right to use that product. And these bills, 2110, 2231, and 2533, all increase that tax on this minority of Oregonians. And I think it's extremely important that you understand who they are. And again, tobacco companies don't pay this tax. Oregonians pay this tax. If you go to the next page of the packet, is what we call a current tax overview. And this shows what Oregonians at different income levels pay both in annual income taxes and what they pay in tobacco taxes. So you will note that those earning under $10,000 only pay $50 in income taxes, but they pay $551 for the right to smoke the product in this state. Those between 10 and 15 pay $253 in income taxes, and again $551 in tobacco taxes. And you'll see the cutting line is about $20,000. Above $20,000, they're paying a little bit more in income taxes than what they're paying in tobacco taxes. And tobacco taxes are both $1.18 and the calculation for the master settlement agreement, which is 33 cents per pack. And that's just for someone who smokes one pack per day. And again, I think it's extremely important that you look at who is paying and how much they're paying in this state. And then you see another data pack, a data sheet there that looks at Oregon smokers' contribution to the state economy. And this is for fiscal year 2010. And this is where you see the $284 million paid by smokers in this state, that these proposals are asking to increase that amount even more. The Oregon smokers' median household income is $29,588. That's the smokers' median income. The non-smokers' median income in Oregon is almost twice that at $54,285, which, again, I think reinforces our belief that this tax is regressive and it's aimed at the poorest Oregonians in this state. I do want to point out a correction where we say 57.4% of Oregon smokers had household incomes less than $25,000. I didn't catch that. That should be $35,000, and I apologize for that mistake. But that corresponds to the previous chart that I had given you. Again, we pay $555 average if you smoke one pack a day in Oregon per smoker. This is larger than, in terms of the total taxes collected from smokers in the state of Oregon, is larger than all the state liquor sales at $186 million that we make in the state, six times larger than the insurance tax proceeds that we collect, $43 million, and three times larger than the estate tax revenues in this state, $98 million. Again, I'm trying to emphasize the large amount that Oregon smokers today pay in terms of this tax. And I've given you some other data there, but it, again, emphasizes that same profile of the person who's paying this tax that these bills want to increase even further. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerard, I'm curious, do you have stores in Washington?
Yes, we do. Very few. We have two in Vancouver and four in Seattle.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And do you offer cigarettes for sale at those establishments?
Yes, sir, we do.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please, yeah.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Kosison, but I'd like to predicate it with a comment. We've heard a lot of testimony against the bills that would increase the cigarette tax. We've heard fairly scant testimony against lifting the local preemption, although I did hear Mr. Kosison offer the argument that there would be a transfer of revenue to Washington. I think it's worth noting in the packet that we have the differential rates between Washington and Oregon before the committee, and that the Washington rate is over 2.5 times higher than the Oregon rate. So I'm curious, Mr. Kosison, if you could help me understand the theory behind preempting local decision-making and why Representative Bence's community and my community should be treated exactly the same when it comes to the choices that they are able to make around cigarette policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Bailey, with I think last week or two, I feel like you're kind of picking on me, but that's a good question. Just in terms of how the tax system works today, in terms of a closed system with the distributor purchasing the stamp, stamping the product, and going out to a market at the retail end, if you had 36 different counties, I think that would be problematic to start with. I think it would further drive people and elicit more of the black market and gray market activity, which I think the state should undertake diligent efforts to end. I think you could pick up literally 20%, 25%, and maybe 30% more if you could collect all legitimate tax revenues in the state of Oregon. But in terms of your transfer of dollars, which you alluded to, if you were just simply to take a look at the differential between Oregon and Washington on a per capita basis, and the numbers here probably are about a year old, but if you took half of the differential between Oregon sales and Washington sales on a per capita basis and suggested, for example, Multnomah County instituting a fairly significant tax, losing and driving those sales to other counties or back to the state of Washington or to other states, you could pretty readily, and current numbers would show that you would lose somewhere between, in total dollars, again with a significant Multnomah County tax, I would suggest you could easily project losses to the Oregon Health Plan of $5 to $15 million.
Yeah, please.
Oh, Mr. Chair. I'd be curious to see the numbers on that. I would imagine that that's true if the definition of a significant Multnomah County tax were, say, $15 a pack or something. But it would seem that there is a reasonable and rational debate to be had about the ability for local jurisdictions to make those choices, and that there is significant headroom between our neighbor to the north and us in terms of tax rates to have that discussion. And for this committee that has had the pleasure of debating significant issues related to local choices and local options around such programs as enterprise zones or other places where our counties are weighing the pros and cons of how they move forward on their tax policy, I think this fits nicely into that overall framework.
Mr. Chair,
please.
May I follow up on my question now that I know the context?
Please, sure.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Bailey, your question to me about our Washington stores, if the implication is that the tax differential had no change, that's not a correct inference. Our Seattle stores didn't flicker when Washington raised their tax about a year and a half ago, but the border stores are dramatic. Our close to the border stores in Vancouver are down like 20%. Our border stores in Washington, I can't tell you how much they're up. They're up much, much more than that, and it shocked us. And
do you mean Portland or Oregon?
In Oregon,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Hayden Island Airport Way.
Thank you. Yeah, you said Washington, but I think you meant Oregon.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah.
Yes, and what that told us is people are driving miles and miles and miles further than just Vancouver to come over to Oregon to purchase tobacco. So there is a huge shift. We see similar things in gasoline. You think people wouldn't drive very far to save 2 cents a gallon, but because they burn up more gas getting there, but they do. So there was a huge cross-border dramatic shift, and the further in from the border south that you come, it tapers off. But there was a very huge shift. So please don't assume that they won't cross the border.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
at the risk of prolonging this, and I apologize for the lengthy back and forth.
Yeah, and we do have a number of other people to be heard from, but go ahead and ask your question.
Well, I just wanted to clarify the inference that I was making to ensure that we had that on the record. The inference was not to imply that there are never changes in location decisions that are made when prices change. And I would imagine that in this case there's whole reams of data that might be presented. Correlation is not always causality, and it might very well be the case that we have Washingtonians coming to Oregon to take advantage of our statewide duty-free shopping with no sales tax, and while they're here they pick up cigarettes on the side. There are a number of different factors that might play into those cross-border issues. The inference was simply to say that there are clearly stores that are operating in Washington that are selling cigarettes at a higher rate, that are continuing to make sales at a rate that is over 2.5 times higher than the state of Oregon. And the rest of the data can be weighed as local jurisdictions make their decisions. So, positive. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garrett, thanks for your testimony. Glad you're here again. I was particularly struck by your testimony about having 750 employees and a full range of benefits, including health insurance. I think that's terrific. Glad to hear it. I wondered, my employer offers a credit against premiums if I make a pledge not to use tobacco. I wonder if you do anything like that or have considered that.
We do cover some. We have two plans, a Kaiser, Mr. Chair, and Representative Reed. There are some smoking cessation provisions in some pieces of our health coverage. We have basic Kaiser Permanente HMO, and then there is an option called Added Choice where the employee, if they want to go see their own doctor, can buy up to that. And within the Added Choice, there are some benefits, but as far as promoting that, no, we haven't done that.
Thank you.
Incidentally, our company's premium last year was $2 million. The company paid portion. That's $20,000 per store for health insurance. It's not insignificant.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. I wouldn't put words in the mouth of my employer, but I think part of the reason that they offer the credit is that they found significant benefit when employees are not smoking and reduced costs.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to move to Mr. Nelson's interesting presentation about who Oregon smokers are, and I just had a couple questions, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will note that I've already asked staff to give us demographic information that compares with Mr. Kosasan's chart. I forget.
Mr. Nelson's chart.
Mr.
Nelson's, yes.
And so we'll get that information.
Okay. These are fairly specific.
Please, go ahead.
So for an average smoker, how many packs of cigarettes might they purchase over the course of a week?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, for our purposes of this analysis, we just did an average of one pack. I don't know what the average number of packs are smoked in Oregon. I believe it's at least one, and I think the national average is probably maybe 1.3. I was going to say 1.2, but 1.3 packs being the national average, I would assume that would be the same in Oregon.
So for an individual smoker, 1.3 packages of cigarettes per week?
Per day.
Oh, per day. Thank you for that clarification. I was trying to compare. So if the cost of a pack of cigarettes is $5.41, and you've pointed out that these are some of the lowest income Oregonians, currently a gallon of milk is $2.99 in Oregon, a dozen eggs is $1.19, and a pound of potatoes is 49 cents. So that would be typical grocery cart for a family of three. That adds up to less than the pack of cigarettes over the course of a week, let alone one over the course of a day. And I'm wondering, given the concern that the industry is showing today for low-income Oregonians, if you could explain the pervasiveness of marketing in low-income neighborhoods to families that are having a difficult time getting those eggs and milk and potatoes and loaves of bread into their grocery carts when so much money is going into, as you pointed out, purchasing this very expensive product, and what the industry is doing to pull their marketing out of these low-income Oregonians to be consistent with your advocacy for their financial well-being today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, you assume that I agree with your statement that there is a pervasiveness of advertising by companies in low-income neighborhoods, which I don't. I would take you to the one chart, which I didn't take you to, which shows it's the last page of my packet, which shows to you how a pack of cigarettes at $5.41 breaks down. And you'll note that 33% of that $5.41 is in Oregon profit taxes, or the state of Oregon in terms of taxes. Another 22% or total goes to other government profit for 55%. And you come on down, manufacturers' cost at 22%, 18% estimated average wholesale and retail markup, and 5% manufacturers' profit. I would take you to that the state of Oregon is one that is truly profiting from a sale of a pack of cigarettes in this state.
Well, just as a brief follow-up, one clarification, the other government profit, is that the MSA payments received? Is that what's considered to be that other?
No, that, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, that's the federal government.
Okay. And then one final question. You disagree with the assessment that there is substantial marketing to low-income Oregonians. What do you perceive is the reason why most Oregon smokers are low-income? Is that simply an accident? I mean, if it's not being marketed to low-income Oregonians and teenagers and young people, how is it that these happen to be the people most likely to purchase the product?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I don't know. Those are the people. That is the demographic in Oregon as it is in other states. Cigarette smokers tend to be less income, tend to be of more of a percentage of minorities and poorer people, and in some cases less educated. Does that mean that cigarette smokers are more ignorant? And no, it just happens to be the demographic of that particular class of users.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just note, kind of traveling through the state, visiting different parts of the state, it often seems that there are a large number of signs and advertisements for tobacco products in lower income neighborhoods. And it seems to me that that's not accidental.
Thank you. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a couple of questions. Number one, is there a specific proposal that any of you are aware of where Multnomah County is seeking to impose a countywide cigarette tax?
To my, Mr. Chair, and to my knowledge, Representative Wand, no, I am not aware of that. A nice lady by the name of Deborah Cafori, who has been here on a consistent basis, has advocated for that authority, but for a variety of reasons, we would advocate against that authority.
Yes, thank you. The reason why that I asked that question is I'm really concerned about the appetite on the part of Multnomah County in particular for regressive taxation. 2 years ago, they took away our right to vote on a countywide vehicle registration fee, which is also a regressive tax that hurts the poor the hardest. And now, 2 years later, they're coming in asking us to lift a preemption on a cigarette tax. And when I look, I have pretty good knowledge of the median income of the four cities that are in my district, having seen that evidence less than a year ago. And I see that three of the cities, Fairview, Wood Village, and Gresham, fall within the 25 to 35,000 range in median income, meaning that half of their residents make less than that. And Troutdale falls in the next category below in the 35 to 50,000. And when I look at the number of smokers, I see it's 58% and 70% cumulatively. So we know that this is a regressive tax. And I also know from past experience that when the counties come down asking for the authority to tax something, it tends to happen rather quickly. So I'm deeply concerned about the issue of preemption, because I know what will happen. And I know that I represent the areas that will be the hardest hit, the areas that will have the most people who are addicted to this substance that is more addictive than anything else we have and can't stop smoking no matter the cost. And we will be taking food away from them if we continue to push these regressive taxes. I don't think this is the right way to go, and I'm very concerned about how it will negatively impact my district. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brewer. You're passed. All right. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Chuck Tallman, Marty Frank, Alex Kyler. These are the last three I have signed up on House Bill 2385. Of course, you may speak on the other bills as well. Is there anyone else here, raise a hand please, who wants to be heard on House Bill 2385? This is the preemption bill. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Brewer, and members of the committee. I'm Marty France. I'm the Public Health Services Manager for Clackamas County, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2385. In Clackamas County, we recognize our considerable responsibilities to protect the health and well-being of our citizens. At the same time, we're in an environment of very tight budgets and difficult funding for public health services. We know there are no quick and easy solutions to the financing problems that we face at all levels of government. And we urge that you consider lifting the preemption on counties raising local revenues to address tobacco use specifically in our communities. The use of tobacco products remains a leading contributor to chronic diseases and death in Clackamas County and across the state. In 2007-08, which was the year that I had the most recent numbers for, 17.6, or almost 18% of our 11th graders in Clackamas County identified themselves as smokers. Representative Greenlick has just testified that teenagers are among the most vulnerable to the addictive properties of tobacco, and thus would be most likely to be affected in their adult lives by chronic disease. In a county tobacco opinion survey last December, we found strong local support for no smoking policies in outdoor public areas, and also over 60% strongly favored requiring stores that sell tobacco to provide equal space to public service messages that warn about the health hazards of tobacco use. These are just a couple of the findings of this survey, but what that indicates is that we have citizens in our community that are concerned about this issue, and we would like to have the opportunity to work directly with them to identify ways to address the scourge of tobacco use in our county. Thank you for your consideration of this request and this testimony.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. The Lane County Board of County Commissioners has reviewed House Bill 2385, did come to a conclusion to support the bill, and you've heard a great deal about the preemption. We're obviously in support of lifting the preemption. I want to bring your attention to Section 4, which directs that 20% of the funds raised from a local tax would be dedicated for public health services in the county. Public health services are required and outlined in ORS 431, specifically 416, and one of the requirements of the public health authority is to ensure child and maternal health. In Lane County, we've done a great deal of work around child and maternal health. We have, in fact, one of the higher what's called fetal and infant mortality rates in the state of Oregon, and so we've done a great deal of work to look at what are some of the issues that lead to this unsettling statistic. We think that there is a causation there from tobacco use in the surveys that we've done with the work that's been done after these unfortunate and tragic events with the loss of children in Lane County. And thus, we're very concerned about tobacco use, and we know that cost is one of the key drivers that brings down tobacco use. You know about the plight of counties with regards to secure rural schools funding. We are decreasing the amount of dollars that go into our health and human services. We're obviously very interested in finding new revenue sources to support that important work. And I just want to close here on the topic of regressivity, because you did spend a fair amount of time with it. We're looking, obviously, at how to address the expected downturn in state funding. We've been following very closely the work of the health transformation team. One of the things that falls through the cracks, we think, in that work is a public health authority. And I did want to point out on that topic of regressivity, just a statement from some of the work that staff has done. Typically, 20% of the population enrolled in Medicaid uses 75% of health care resources and services. It's sort of a reverse look, I suppose, at regressivity, but the point being that we've got to examine, much like I think really the debate about even the use of helmets on motorcycles. We all pay for a healthcare system. It is a system. There are cost centers in that system, and as a society, we all pay into it. The issue of regressivity, I think, goes both ways. Where are the cost drivers, and where are the payers?
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Tauman, T-A-U-M-A-N. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and a proud law school classmate of Representative Bentz. I'm here. I will be testifying later in a different capacity on the tobacco tax bill, but on the repeal of preemption bill, I'm here as the president of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, which is the statewide anti-tobacco advocacy organization. It's a nonprofit, independent organization, and also the convener of the of Topical Partners, which is the coalition that is supporting the tobacco tax. But I wanted to mention to you just two quick things that hopefully will be themes that will appeal to the legislators as they vote on this bill, and that is local options and local control. And I think that it's very important. I won't go into the tobacco-related issues, but we all feel that the closer decisions are made to our local communities, the more responsive they are to the will of those communities. And so the repeal of preemption will not enact a cigarette tax. It will not cost taxpayers any money. It will not require a supermajority vote. It will give local jurisdictions an additional option that they don't have now. It will increase local control and make the local decision-making bodies more responsive to their local to the local voters. And so with that, I will be back to talk about the tobacco tax.
Well, actually, you won't. If you want to talk about that, do that now.
I would be happy to do that. In that capacity, I am representing the American Lung Association. I sit on the board of the American Lung Association, and I have... Thank you. And I'm really here to answer some of the questions that came up from the panel that was just previous to this about the tobacco tax, and I'm happy, of course, to answer your questions also. I did notice in the panel there was a lot of facts and figures. There was only one mention of the word health in that, and that is the issue that faces you. The facts and the figures, the profit, the money versus public health. And that is the important policy aspect of this consideration that faces you today. I couldn't help but be affected by the statement of how much money is made on tobacco. Now, if I heard things right from the prior witnesses, if a pack of cigarettes cost $5 per pack, there's $1.01 of federal tax, $1.18 of Oregon tax, that's $2.19. That's $2.81 for the cost of the cigarettes themselves. Mr. Gerard said that his company makes 58 cents gross profit. That means that there's $2.23 in the cost of those materials, and that means that the retailer is making almost 25% profit on the sale. Now, this is gross profit. The fact is that this is a very, very profitable item, and I can understand why the retailers and the cigarette companies are here trying to make sure that they keep their consumption up. As we've heard from public health people, the higher the cost of a pack of cigarettes, the lower the consumption. Still, it's a revenue raiser. There is a net revenue increase. But obviously, people are here to protect their profits. There was some suggestion about the regressiveness of this type of tax. Well, this is a voluntary tax. No one forces anyone to buy a pack of cigarettes. As Representative Juan stated, and I was glad to hear him state that, people are addicted to this product. They cannot, without great, great, great efforts, relieve themselves from this addiction. This is a product that they must buy, and that's why revenue will go up when the tobacco tax goes up. It's something that I lament. That's too bad, but the fact is that revenue will go up. This is only regressive in the sense that people are choosing to buy cigarettes. This is a tax, unlike an income tax, that people can avoid by simply not buying the product. That's easy for us to say. The humanitarian part of the tax scheme is that revenue that is raised, a portion of this revenue, will go toward tobacco prevention. In other words, give people who truly want to quit the help that they need. And we all know that people need a tremendous amount of help in order to successfully quit. So the fact is, while in one sense this tax affects lower socioeconomic and minorities, disproportionately,
The beneficial part of this tax is that it provides funds to help those very people avoid it, avoid, as Representative Gelser said, using, buying a pack of cigarettes instead of milk and potatoes. There was a statement about that the increased tax is driving people to bulk tobacco. Well, the fact is that if these stores didn't sell tobacco that was labeled as pipe tobacco, as roll-your-own tobacco, this would not be a problem because roll-your-own tobacco is taxed at the same level as cigarettes. Okay. What the tobacco companies are doing is relabeling their roll-your-own tobacco as pipe tobacco, thereby taking advantage of a loophole. So the fact that it's driving, potentially driving purchasers into bulk tobacco is strictly a red herring here. Finally, Mr. Brady mentioned that there's a danger of the increase in tax killing the goose that laid the golden egg. Well, everyone, at least from the public health point of view, and people who are concerned, the legislators who are representing the health and welfare of the people of the state of Oregon, are more concerned about the health and of your constituents and keeping people from smoking, or should be, than they are about the profits of these companies. The fact is that a tobacco tax will increase public health, decrease the cost of public health, decrease insurance rates, save Oregonians, Oregon employers, and governments money, and it will actually increase revenue for the state. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We have one person who indicates he's more than 100 miles from home today, and I want to take him next, and that's Mr. Is it Calder, John Calder? Please, come forward.
More than 100 miles away. I'm less than 100 miles.
You're less than 100 miles away.
Okay, well,
you check the well. Why don't you come on up and we'll give your testimony. And we are rapidly running out of time. So if you could confine yourself to 2.5 minutes or less, that would be great.
I will try.
Thank you.
I'm John Calder. I own a tobacco store in Jefferson, which is only 16 miles from the state capitol here.
Thank you.
And I concur with the gentleman from Plaid Pantry on most everything that he said.
Well, you don't need to repeat that then.
Then I'm leaving that out. But anyway, I'll tell you my story. I started 22 years ago as a cigarette store. And we started, I had a low income job. I was working at minimum wage, saved money, and bought products, and had a hard time getting enough money to rent a space to open the store. Well, in the meantime, I did real good every year. I increased my sales every year. And about 8 years ago, the state increased the taxes equivalently to what they're asking now. Well, I had, a year before that, opened a second store. I had 7 employees and 2 stores. Within a year after the last taxes went into effect, I had to close my second store. I laid off 6 employees. I left 1 employee, and I was working. I was working 16 hours a day to keep my business going. After another year, I had to file bankruptcy. My cash out-of-pocket loss was over $100,000. My bankruptcy was $204,000. And this was due to the increase in taxes. Overnight, I went from 100% of my earnings to 25% of my earnings. And that was due to black market cigarettes, internet sales, counterfeit cigarettes, and all types of illegal activity. I had my store broke into several times. Other people had their stores broke into several times. And this is what an increase in taxes does. I will close there unless you have some questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Appreciate it. Okay.
They're all the same.
All the same. Okay. I'm going to have trouble with the name. David, is it Rebarl?
Rebinol.
Jason Parks, Mal Cohn. Gentlemen.
Co-chairs Berger, co-chair Barnhart, members of this committee, good morning. For the record, my name is David Rebinol. I am a senior program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Health Foundation to voice our support for increasing the state's tobacco tax proposed in House Bills 2110, 2553, and 2231, and to fund tobacco prevention and chronic disease prevention programs in our state at local health departments. Very quickly, Northwest Health Foundation is a not-for-profit philanthropic organization that has been working for the past 14 years to improve the health of people of Oregon by supporting community organizations with grants, improving our public health system and workforce, and once in a while getting involved with policy changes that greatly improve the opportunity for health of all Oregonians. And this, we feel, is one key piece to our involvement. We have continued to invest in efforts to curb tobacco use because tobacco use is still the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. And I hope you'll do get a chance to hear from some of our grantees here who do represent communities and the profile of smokers that we were discussing today. These are the very people in support of these ideas. And just quickly, just some big picture perspectives. The foundation has been a participant in the conversations about healthcare reform, and we are aware and appreciate the question that you all face of how to manage some of the bigger cost drivers that has been a part of your discussions. And as reported by the Oregon Health Authority, an increase in the tobacco tax has a clear impact on cost by lowering the number of smokers and in turn lowering the number of smoking-related illnesses that are currently being paid for by the state. In Oregon, this translates to $1.25 billion in direct medical costs. That does factor both public and private payers. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, $347 million of that is in direct Medicaid costs to the Oregon Health Plan. Keep in mind, this is just direct medical costs and not accounting for indirect costs. And last 2 points. Is referring to a chart on the back page of my written testimony. And that the good news is that these measures do, in fact, are reliable sources of substantial revenue. We're talking about increasing the tax on a pack of cigarettes anywhere between 85 to 250%. And we know that when the price of a pack of cigarettes goes up, we can expect consumption to drop. But since consumption drops more slowly than the price rate increase, the net effect is a substantial revenue gain, and numerous economic studies have proven this. We asked the Oregon Health Authority to provide to us their revenue estimates based on the Office of Economic Analysis March 2011 revenue forecast. Again, the chart is on the back of my page, and I really want to just point out that the revenue estimates range from $250 million to $358 million in the 2011-2013 biennium, and as much as $456 million in the 2013-2015 biennium. The bottom line is that all these bills would raise more than $250 million per biennium. Finally, we support these measures because increasing tobacco taxes saves lives. We support these taxes because an increase in the rate also has the important public health impact of driving the number of teen smokers. The tobacco companies oppose this tax for the same reason. They know that 90% of smokers start as teens. In fact, in Oregon, 31,600 high school students smoke, with 4,000 more starting every year. The fewer teens that start smoking, the fewer adults who will suffer from chronic illnesses associated with a lifetime of smoking. These measures will save lives and raise revenue. And we ask that you support increasing the state's tobacco tax this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Parks. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network here in Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2110, 2231, and 2533. The American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, or ACS-CAN, is the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy partner of the American Cancer Society, and we support evidence-based policy and legislative solutions designed to eliminate cancer as a health problem here in the U.S. As such, we support significantly increasing the tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products in Oregon. From a health impact perspective, increasing tobacco excise taxes on cigarettes is one of the most cost-effective strategies to reducing tobacco use among adults and prevent youth from starting to smoke.
I noticed that you're reading your testimony, and we have a number of other people to hear from. If you could hit the high points in a short bit, that would be very helpful.
Sure. Increasing the tax by 10% is proven to decrease youth smoking by 7%, overall by 4%. It's true that the minorities and low-income populations are heaviest hit, but they would also reap the most benefits by raising the taxes, forcing them to quit. They're four times more likely to quit with a tax increase. And also, with the amount of tax increase going to the CDC recommended levels and prevention education for tobacco, that would also benefit the people who are devastated by this smoking. So we support these tax bills and putting the money towards prevention education. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ron.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the public health director and the state public health officer. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to testify today. I will be brief. First point that I want to make is that from my vantage point as the public health director, tobacco use continues to be the leading preventable cause of death in Oregon. There is nothing else that is even close. Many of you have heard me speak very passionately about obesity prevention or influenza or other public health issues we face. Tobacco is still number one, so very, very important. The second is that we all bear the costs of tobacco use. It's a very, very expensive problem for us. You've heard it said earlier that a pack of cigarettes costs, you know, a little over $5 a pack or so. It's been calculated that the actual cost in terms of medical expenses incurred by using that pack of cigarettes is over $13. So who pays for that difference? Well, we all do. It gets passed on in increased insurance premiums that we all pay both in the public and private sector. So that is it's a very, very expensive problem for us. And then the third point, excuse me, I want to emphasize is that raising price is a very effective tool. This has been well researched. The Centers for Disease Control has blessed this, if you will, as a best practice. And we know, particularly for young people, Representative Greenlick referred to the fact that starting to smoke when you're young is really a very, very important piece of this problem. Young people are particularly price sensitive, and so this is an especially effective tool for preventing young people from starting to smoke. And finally, I want to just make a comment about this regressivity issue. You know, here we have a very highly effective tool to prevent people from smoking. It is undeniable that the number of smokers among low-income people here in Oregon and across the country is much higher than in wealthier people. So to me, what is truly a regressive public policy, if you will, is failing to enact and failing to use all of the tools that we have at our disposal to help this group of folks quit smoking and escape from this very, very addicting substance. So I wanted to say that to you and note in that context that Oregon is the only state that has reduced its cigarette tax in the last decade. So you all have an opportunity to address this issue. I think it's a very, very serious one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We very much appreciate your testimony. Ellen Lowe, Rebecca Bell, I'm going to really mess up the neck. Oh,
Jen
Borney.
Sue.
I'm not even close, am I?
Yes.
Yes.
Good morning.
Before she gets started, I will note that I suspect we may not get through the whole list this morning right at 10 o'clock. I'm going to ask those who want to testify who haven't if they can come back on Tuesday morning. And I'll ask for a show of hands at that time. If I get any, we'll reopen the public hearing on Tuesday morning, please.
And I say thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Vice-Chairs, and then members of the House Revenue Committee. I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm the community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the people that our 58 hospitals serve. And I really want to thank you for having this hearing and advancing a discussion about a healthy form of revenue. You've just heard some testimony about the level of low income that is there for many of the people who do use tobacco. And you've heard about the costs to individuals, to the communities, and to the health systems. And as you think about regressivity, I'd ask you to really look at the savings that could be there by increasing the cost of tobacco products, and then the services that could be there for those who currently use these items. Because when I hear over $5 a pack for cigarettes, and I think of the income level of people who are using these, because we do see them as members of the Oregon Health Plan. We do see them in our emergency rooms. And what we would be able to do with additional augmented targeted cessation programs in these communities where the use is so high. And then the other thing I think of is those of you who are part of the health conversations right now, and we think about triple aim, health, health services, and costs. And that in this way, it isn't just the cost to all of us in some direct, some indirect, but really then the kind of contribution we could be making. Many of these individuals we see because they are victims of chronic disease that are directly related to their tobacco use. And part of the healthcare reform discussions right now is looking at patient-centered services for those who are living with a chronic disease. And so that's another offering we could make. So when people can quit smoking, and I got a feeling I'm not the only one in this room who once smoked, it can work if those cessation programs are targeted correctly. And I think that Dr. Melcon and his folks can make sure that can happen. But also within the health services that we provide. And so I thoroughly reject the note that this is regressive. It really is providing the opportunity for savings for Oregon's low income who have become victims of addiction to nicotine. Now, just briefly before we look at the poll.
And if you could wrap up, that
okay,
would be very helpful.
Just to say that your usual cast of characters, you've heard from some of them, we got together last summer, and we decided that it was critically important that we begin to look at how Oregon had fallen behind in tobacco cessation services and in health care. But we also looked at the political climate. Remember those brochures you used in the primaries, last year, and then you were getting ready for the general election. None of you mentioned increasing taxes, did you? And so we knew what the political climate was, so we decided that it was critical that we get the best firm in the state to do a polling survey for us so that if we could find out where Oregonians were. And I should say that I almost decided we didn't make the right decision when they decided to go out the first week of September, when the ads on all of the airwaves and the printed press were rampant with messages that really weren't in our favor. But I think when Rebecca now talks about the poll, you'll find that we did it at the right time, because if we could get those answers.
Thank you. We are very close to out of time, and if we're going to hear from Rebecca, we need to do
okay.
It. Thank
Rebecca
you.
Ball, from who with Tim Hibbets got us through this.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Ball. I'm an associate at Davis Hibbets and Mitchell. As Ms. Lowe mentioned, my testimony is in regards to a telephone survey we conducted last September of voters. You have a summary of the poll in front of you, but a couple of quick points. On the methodology, it was of 500 registered voters. We used a registered voter list that included landlines and cell phones. And we set quotas by age, gender, political party, and area of state to ensure we had a representative sample. Looking at the findings, some quick highlights. 71% of voters supported a $1 per pack increase to the state cigarette tax, with the money directed to health services and tobacco prevention and cessation programs. 51% of those voters strongly supported it, so support is high, and strong support is also high. We saw majority support across age, gender, area of state, and political party. On this note, on tax increases, especially in the last several years, the biggest difference of opinion is between political party, and the cigarette tax is an exception to this. 6 in 10 Republicans said they support the tax. 3/4 of Democrats and independents support this tax. Another note on attitudinal differences is, at the beginning of the survey, we wanted to gauge people's opinions towards tax increases generally. There is some opposition to tax increases. However, among those that have the attitude in opposition to tax increases, a majority of those people were in support of the cigarette tax increase. We also wanted to gauge voter opinion toward the regressive nature of this tax. On multiple points in the survey, voters did not view it as regressive. And there was recognition that this tax benefits low-income Oregonians if the funds are directed toward health services, tobacco cessation, and tobacco prevention. And this leads to a final point about how revenue could be directed from this increase. We did a head-to-head test among voters if they would favor it being directed toward the general fund to reduce the deficit or toward health services and tobacco prevention programs. 64% of voters preferred it go toward health services and tobacco prevention programs, and findings were very similar across age, gender, political party, and area of state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Members, Co-Chair Berger and Barnhart, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Janman Mal Su, and I'm on the board of directors of Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon.
If you'll move the mic just a couple more inches further away from you,
okay.
It will distort less.
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. And from parents who came from Cambodia by way of Thailand. In Cambodian community, we face some of the highest rates of cigarettes use. It was well documented that over 50% of Cambodian males smoke, and I experienced this in my own family with my father, who smoked for over 40 years. Why? Reasons include the Khmer Rouge genocide campaign that encouraged cigarettes to suppress appetite, the trauma of immigrating as refugees and persistent poverty, and the racism that community members face. It is clear that reducing tobacco use would bring big benefits to everyone in Oregon, including the Asian and Pacific Islander communities and communities of color. Tobacco use is the most preventable cause of death in the United States, and we know that the most effective way to reduce tobacco is to increase cigarette taxes. Hundreds of studies in the U.S. and around the world show that this is to be true. For communities of people experience poverty, a 10% increase in prices of cigarettes will result in 8% decreasing in smoking. It is no wonder that The tobacco industry is against cigarette taxes. Why people smoke less? When people smoke less, tobacco industry profits go down. So the tobacco industry claims that the tobacco tax hurts low-income Oregonians and that the tobacco tax is regressive. They say it's regressive. They say it is regressive. Cancer rates in Oregon are regressive. Heart disease rates in Oregon are regressive. The premature death of Asians and Pacific Islanders and communities of color is regressive. Communities of color, immigrants, and refugees suffer from higher rates of smoking. And once diagnosed with smoking-related cancers, we have the higher mortality rate than our white counterparts. We know that raising taxes is one of few tobacco control efforts that is more effective in low-income communities. The tobacco industry wants you to think that it is a bad thing. We appreciate that this committee cares about the low-income Oregonians. What is best for low-income Oregonians is to increase the tobacco tax, and there is more we can do. A good portion of the new revenue from the cigarette tax needs to go to help even more smokers quit. We can reduce tobacco use, we can reduce health care costs, and we can help all Oregonians lead full, productive lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned earlier in your testimony about the high rates of smoking in Cambodia and some of the reasons for that. Earlier, we talked about why it might be that low-income and minority Oregonians are more likely to smoke. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that's an accident, or do you believe that that is related to active marketing by tobacco companies?
I agree with you that the marketing of the tobacco companies was more prevalent in low-income communities. And if according to recent census or separate aggregated data in API community, Southeast Asians have 52% of them are less likely to have a high school diploma, and I think it was like 22% that are living below the poverty rate. So yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. We appreciate it very much. I note that this is the first time we've come to this situation at 10 o'clock when it's time to adjourn for the day, and that is that I still have people who I don't have a check mark next to their name. Are any of the people who have signed up and would like to be heard on any of these bills today available on Tuesday morning to come back? Because if you are, We will reopen, and I see several hands, so we will reopen these bills for further testimony on Tuesday morning next week, 8 o'clock, and have met the required notice? I have. Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing today on all of these bills, and we are adjourned, and we'll see you Tuesday.